across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! So, chaotic scenes at Belfast International Airport over the weekend. Passengers stranded, not being able to get through security. Michelle O'Neill laying a wreath on Remembrance Day. The monitoring round and money and hearts going to be divvied up among the different government departments. And all of the callers that come to talk about the news on The Nolan Show. All coming up this morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. Chaos and chaotic scenes at Belfast International Airport on Saturday morning as yet again passengers miss flights at that airport because yet again of long delays getting through security. Now, the reason this is interesting is Belfast International Airport have invested a lot of money into trying to improve the airport, and they themselves are suggesting what happened on Saturday was totally unacceptable. Tom Breen was a passenger. Morning to you, Tom.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So describe what you saw when you were up there on Saturday morning. First of all, how much in front of your flight? How early did you arrive?
Well, you arrived in good time. And whenever we were just going up to the departures, we turned the corner to go to the departures and we looked and the queue was coming down the stairs. We just got into the queue. Waited then and thought maybe it was something to do with the scan the boarding passes because the escalators weren't working at the same time. So we were like, we'll just wait. We waited there for, I don't know how long it was. We were just kind of curious at the time and just trying to get up the stairs. I think we could have been waiting there about 20 minutes, half an hour, trying to get up the stairs. Once we get to the top of the stairs, then I was with my brother and he was the one who went over and asked one of the people who worked there, is there anything we can do that what's going on? And they just said it was a shortage of staff. But there was somebody who was more panicked than us on the same flight. And she actually was up whenever my brother was speaking as well. And she went through the fast track herself without paying for it or nothing. But she seemed to have got through, no problem. And we waited in the queue fearing we'd lose our place. So we thought it was just kind of going to be, whenever we were walking through, maybe it was an issue with the boarding pass or the passing situation. So we went through it, got through it then. And we realised that there was about 1,000 people in security, maybe more. And we had to just wait. And it just took ages to get through. And whenever we got through
So hundreds and hundreds of people then waiting, trying to get through security?
I'd imagine so. I didn't count, but I'd imagine it would have been about 1,000 people, I'd say. Maybe the guts even more.
And they've got six new lanes up there, don't they? How many of those were manned?
Open, two. That was the issue they told us. So it was the most busiest period probably on Saturday morning and they only had two open.
And but are they communicating with you? Are they telling you of the tannoys? Relax, we're trying to get on top of this?
No. So I went on Facebook, Belfast International Messenger and just clicked on, typed in my flight. They said then, this is where kind of gets interesting with our flight. I clicked on it and was following the flight the whole way through, so it was saying boarding. We were just all right. We were thinking it was going to be okay. We then got through security. It said final call. We got to our gate. We watched them board. We watched the people going up the stairs, rang through, out. There was 26 of us, didn't get the flight. We watched them go up, watched the doors close. And we actually phoned up whenever we landed. I think flight was due to go off at 9:15. We landed at 9:10. We watched them board. And
so they kept you off the flight?
Yeah. 26.
It's their fault. They're saying it's totally unacceptable what they did. And yet you miss your flight. They don't sort you out with a flight.
No. Well, now, credit to the staff there. It was brilliant what they did. Like, you know, there was a woman came around and she looked after us, all of us. And she was, well, it was EasyJet who had one informed us that there's 26 people missing on this flight. And at the gate. But they said the gates are closed.
Why didn't they delay the flight?
Said they did delay the flight as much as possible. What angers me about it is it was the other way around. We'd be sitting waiting as a passenger, as a customer. You'd be sitting waiting you could be sitting 2 hours. On a delayed flight, but they couldn't wait maybe 15 to 10 minutes for 26 passengers on that flight.
There are some reports that that there was such chaos that people were shouting in there on Saturday morning, that people were all bunged into the one area. Can you describe it to us?
Oh, I didn't experience any of that, but you're just bunged in. I did hear reports of that, but we didn't experience any of that there, but apparently just a wee bit before us, maybe, that was going on. But our flight, people said they just had seconds to get through the gate, but I don't know why they just didn't hold the gate open for another 20 minutes or so.
The travel writer Tim Hedgley with us today. Here we go again. Like, how do you plan? How do you book a holiday? How do you bring kids with you? How do you take time off work or school if one of our major airports can't have the basics right? In other words, staff a security lane to the point where you make your flight. How do business people coming in and out of this country?
I really don't know. You put your head in your hands and you just think, this is our advert to the rest of the world, how efficient Northern Ireland is. Our international airport, and we can't even get passengers through security. You know, we've had this before and before and before, and it continues to go on. Now, clearly, it's an issue with getting staff into the airport to provide the security service, but it's just so bad. It just gets worse and worse. And we've discussed this problem many times at the international airport.
And they invested money and they have expanded their infrastructure. They've put in these beautiful, I was up there a few months ago, beautiful new high-tech lanes, but they didn't have the staff to provide to keep them open on Saturday. The international airports say they suffered a significant staff shortage due to short-term illness. Well, what does that mean? Like, what's a significant staff shortage? Do they not have people that they can move into it at the last minute?
Well, they obviously don't. And at the end of the day, you know, if you're running staff at an airport and you desperately need staff to be there, then you have to pencil in, you know, rosters that will cover for emergencies. So it's better to have two or three extra staff in the event that somebody falls ill. But, you know, how many times have we had this conversation with the international airport? And it's interesting, we don't seem to have the issue at the city airport. So what's going wrong at the international that they cannot get staff? Is it the fact that they're not paying enough? Are they not giving enough perks to the staff? You know, there has to be some incentive to have the right number of staff there, because the first part of your holiday is the check-in. Once you've checked in, security can make or break your holiday. And if you've got half a dozen children, it just wrecks it.
Well, the international airport say that they were working with their security provider, Wilson James. That's the name of the company. They say additional staff were brought in and they worked urgently alongside Wilson James to understand the issues to ensure this doesn't happen again. Well, it's about staff shortage, they're telling us. So how do you mitigate against that? Security wait times, they said, returned to normal within 90 minutes. Passengers moved well throughout the facility since mid-morning on Saturday. Jim in Lisburn. Morning, Jim.
Hi, Stephen. Yeah, international airport. Well, I'll not use that word international because that would be false representation, I think. But this is the same thing. They've spent a fortune putting in six of these new machines. Last time I was there was only one of them open. It was exactly the same, huge queues.
Was that recently?
It's about a month ago.
There's only one open?
There's only one open, yeah.
And did it need more than one?
Oh, absolutely. It needed three or four open. Even. They're bunching all these flights together. So you've got your early morning flights to the UK. You've got your holiday flights. See, by about 10:30 in the morning, place is empty. Place is empty at 10:30. That's what the security guy told me. He says, you come here at 10:30. He says, there's no one here. But he says, they're bunching all the flights together. So everyone arrives and you get a perfect storm.
What I'm noticing here, on the statement from the International Airport, any passengers impacted by the issues on Saturday morning are asked to contact the airport on an email address they give out here to ensure we can assist those affected directly. Now, that's interesting wording. Are they going to refund? Are they going to compensate passengers for being delayed? Are they going to compensate? Are they going to pay out money to passengers who missed their flights?
Don't know, but I think people are voting with their feet. I was through the city airport last week, going to Birmingham, Bristol, and people were saying that, you know, international airport, I'm avoiding it like the plague at the moment, especially business people.
Well, now, Andrew, also calling us this morning. Andrew, you're suggesting that this is not a one-off. The international airport suggesting that, you know, this was short-term illness. You can infer from that this is a one-off. What have you seen, Andrew, in your experience with them last week?
Friday morning, me and two friends were going to Birmingham. Place again was chock-a-block. It was clear to be seen that there wasn't enough security staff, only two lanes operating.
On Friday morning?
Friday morning, yes. Our flight was at 10:35 to Birmingham. And again, there was long, long queues. And there were two supervisors working about. And they were just laughing and joking. They didn't seem to...
Well, no. Though, I'm sure those supervisors were working diligently, and we cannot say that.
There was laughter on their face.
Well, look...
That's all I can say.
Well, look...
Well, my next point is...
That's not acceptable. Hold on a minute. Those supervisors, I'm sure, were doing everything they could. And the problem here is clearly above a supervisor level. The problem here is about manning and having enough people on the ground. Supervisors don't decide that. That's a staffing issue. That's a management issue. Well, so how long did you wait?
We were in the queue for... We were early, which we were very lucky. We were queuing in security for 45 minutes. Now, there's one thing I'd like you to ask them. To say that there's people in the sick, I would question that. Ask them how many is on their payroll and how many was off sick. I think they're working with small numbers to save money. The security end. And another point I want to make. The girl on the security end, shoes off, belts off, watches off. I didn't take my shoes off. I pulled my pullover down over my belt and I pulled my short sleeve over my watch.
What? Well, you're part of the problem.
No. I walked through the zone. Not a problem.
Well, how did the equipment not pull that up?
Because it doesn't pull it up. I have done it before. It's just, I don't know. Why would you
be doing that?
Well, you ask them that. Them three items, I wore them. And no beep.
Tim Hedgley, what is the problems will happen in any company. Andrew, it just seems unbelievable what Andrew's talking about there. But in terms of the general delays, we have no doubt that's happening. Like, has the international airport got such a grip? Because, look, you've got the international, you've got Belfast City, and that's it in terms of Belfast. Do they not need to care here?
They need to care a lot more. They need a lot more staff during the busy times. As one of your previous callers said, that they do group flights. You know, it's like London buses. If you don't see one for hours and then all of them come at the same time, and that's due to rostering, to have the ground staff, the baggage handlers, they want to have them all together to lift all the baggage in the flat at one time. But somebody mentioned about compensation, and this is something that I think some of the passengers should look into. It's a general rule that the terms and conditions of an airline, you're not entitled to compensation if you miss your flight due to delayed security check. This is because the responsibility for arriving at the airport in time lies with the traveller themselves. However, exceptions may apply depending on the circumstances. And it looks as though, I'm not a lawyer, but it looks as though that the circumstances on Friday and Saturday morning were not normal, and it took an unreasonable amount of time to go through. So if passengers are affected, I would suggest they contact the Consumer Council or a lawyer to see if they can get their flights refunded.
Tim, thank you. We'll continue to take your calls this morning, 030 30 80 55 55. I'm sure we'll come back to some of you later in the programme. Next, the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, has become the first senior Sinn Féin figure to take part in an official Remembrance Sunday ceremony. Miss O'Neill led a laurel wreath at the Cenotaph, at Belfast City Hall in her role as First Minister. A message on the wreath led by the Sinn Féin Vice President stated, "Today I remember all lives lost in the horror of war and conflict, past and present." She said it was part of her promise to be a First Minister for all.
I understand that everybody has different perspectives, but it was important for me to be here today as First Minister. I pledged from day one that I would represent everybody fairly in our society, and for me this is a fulfilment of that commitment, and actually to be here to remember all those people that lost their lives in the horror of conflict. And it's okay to have different perspectives and different experiences of the past, but for me this is about the journey that we're on towards a shared future.
While her attendance at the event was broadly welcomed, not everyone has been supportive of the decision. A letter signed by 100 members of Republican families from Tyrone accused her of populism and said Sinn Féin had turned political somersaults into an Olympic sport.
I think, Stephen, it wasn't the easiest decision that I've...
Earlier, I've been speaking, as you can hear, to the TUV's Ron McDowell and Chris Donnelly, commentator and former Sinn Féin election candidate.
I think, Stephen, it wasn't the easiest decision that I've ever made. It was a decision that came from much soul-searching, but ultimately I had to make a decision that I could live with, and it came down to a few points. And the first point that it came down to was, did I believe Michelle O'Neill? Did I believe that she was there to reach the open hand of friendship? And I have to say, I didn't believe her. From my own perspective, when it was confirmed that Michelle O'Neill would be attending, my first response was one of scepticism. I simply didn't believe that she was there to remember the fallen or that she was there to build bridges. I personally believe that she was there on the back of all the negative publicity that Sinn Féin have had over the last number of weeks. So, first of all, I suspected that she was there with the wrong motivations. So, paralleled with that is also her history, her legacy on troubles related issues, when she said there's no alternative to the horrors that went on in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. And for everyone to go along and just pretend that the past didn't happen, well, I think that really flies in the face of what the day is all about. There are two aspects of Sunday that we remember. One is Remembrance Day, we remember. And the motto of that is, lest we forget. I can't forget what happened. I can't forget the injustices of the Troubles. And unless there's a genuine attempt to address that from Sinn Féin and from Michelle O'Neill and from the hierarchy of republicanism, then it wasn't an event that I could go to. And I really regret that I couldn't go to it.
But so we just, everything, if you take your thesis, everything stands still. Nobody moves on. Michelle O'Neill can't reach out to people like you or others. She can't, despite her mandate, be a First Minister for everyone with gestures, with events like this. We stand still.
Michelle O'Neill has it in her power to reach out. Michelle O'Neill has it in her power to give that progress, to give the progression that Northern Ireland so desperately needs. A few weeks ago, we were told that the IRA Army Council still controlled Sinn Féin. Michelle O'Neill has said there was no alternative but to the bomb and the murder and the mayhem that went on in
Belfast. Well, the Chief Constable
Belfast
has since, as you know, said that there actually hasn't been another formal assessment like that back in 2015. But look,
and that's the most up-to-date information that we have at the minute, is that the IRA Army Council still exists and still directs Sinn Féin. So when I go to the Cenotaph, when I go to the City Hall on Sunday, I drive down the Shankill Road, I drive by the Mountain View Bar, I drive by the Beardo Bar where the bombs were, I drive by the Balmoral Furniture Showroom area, I drive by the Shankill bombing, and there was no alternative to any of that. And when I take the walk to the Cenotaph, there are little plots laid out for the various regiments of the British Army, and by far the most heavily populated area is the one for the Ulster Defence Regiment. And the vast majority of the Ulster Defence Regiment members who were killed by the IRA, quite often when they were at home in front of their children. And one of the wee crosses when I went down, I didn't abandon Remembrance Sunday. I went down after the event and laid my own wreath. One of the little crosses that was in the UDR plot simply said, "My daddy, my hero." And if I just go and pretend that everything's normal and that everything's okay, then who's going to be the voice of the victims in all of this?
Chris Donnelly?
Yeah, I think, Stephen, with regard to this, remembrance in a divided society, it's something that needs to be handled sensitively, both with regard to respecting other people's rights to remember, but also in being mindful of the victims created by those being remembered. And that includes yesterday, because what doesn't get talked about often, because of the way that British remembrance is often presented by the media in this part of the world, is that the British created an awful lot of victims in Ireland over an awful long period of time. And that's something that, when it gets presented in this manner, is something that cuts deep within the nationalist psyche. And that's why for Michelle O'Neill to do what she did from the nationalist and Republican perspective was quite a moment. Is very significant from a Republican perspective to change their policy on being involved in British Remembrance event that, you know, in the past they would have restricted that to occasions of marking remembrance related to World War One or World War Two. And what they were doing there was saying, look, we mightn't have agreed. After all, at the time of World War One, Republicans were fighting for independence, 1916 Easter Rising. But they were acknowledging the historical anomalies and complexities of things. They always drew the line at being involved in this type of event, precisely because people out there were made victims and had relatives killed by the UDR, by the RUC, by the parachute resin, by the B specials. So this was a very significant moment where Sinn Féin effectively took a leadership decision to move that line. And that's why you saw a response. You saw it very publicly from Tyrone last week, but it cuts more deeper with the nationalists. It was a very genuine, I have to give them this, it was a very genuine and sincere move because it's
Was it, Chris? Because cynics might think, you look at the likes of the Lucid Talk poll out today, which is suggesting that Michelle O'Neill's popularity after the child abuse scandals within Sinn Féin has plummeted. The timing of her doing this, cynics might think it's all about her, it's all about Sinn Féin, it's a political move. It's a political move to move the agenda on, to distract.
I'll say this, I'll put it this way, Stephen. Even that suggestion betrays so much. Because the DUP have been mired in controversy for year upon year related to so many issues. I can tell you, if and when a senior DUP figure attends an Irish Republican commemoration, I doubt the first thing that would be coming within the media would be, was this just a cynical gesture? I think people would reflect and realize the significance of that, given that there are people within the unionist community that have been hurting for decades because of the IRA. So for someone within unionism to take that step, I think people across the board would be less, you know, quick to jump to such a cynical conclusion.
Ron?
I really don't want to get into the rights and the wrongs with Chris Donnelly of the British Army in Northern Ireland on Remembrance Day. I'm not going to get into a political debate. I'm just going to make it clear why I don't think I had the liberty to go on Sunday. And I said earlier, who would be the voice for the victims in all of this? The initial rumour that started to spread around was that Michelle O'Neill was going to go to the Enniskillen Poppy Day massacre, or the remembrance service, which is obviously on the anniversary of the massacre. And nobody has ever known the answers to what unfolded on that day. No one has ever been questioned for what happened on Remembrance Day when that bomb went off. The families still need answers to what took place on that day to give them peace. And no one knows the answers, but the Republican movement knows the answers. Michelle O'Neill knows the answers. And if this is sincere, then the metrics on how you measure sincerity is by giving closure to victims on Remembrance Day. Ultimately, the victims didn't have the confidence in Michelle O'Neill. They said they would have boycotted the event if she turned up. And I'm quite pleased to stand with the victims in all of this on Remembrance Day.
The difficulty with that, Ron, is that no one speaks uniformly for victims in this society. When we are involved in remembrance, whether it's in November or Easter time, there are people who are relatives of victims who were involved in the conflict. And of course, when we're commemorating, we're also commemorating people who contributed towards casualties, towards victims in this society. So when it comes to Republican remembrance or British remembrance, that's why it needs to be handled delicately. That's why historically, before yesterday, there was a line within Republicanism. Michelle O'Neill crossed that line. And I think many people in the society will be saying, is there going to be reciprocation down the line? Are we going to see people from the British tradition in Northern Ireland actually crossing that? Well, there was a line with respect. There was a line, Ron.
So, Councillor Ryan Murphy of the Lord Mayor of Belfast and Sinn Féin Lord Mayor last year took part in the service, and I was at it. So there was no line in the sand. What has rubbed salt into the wound this year is the attitude of Michelle O'Neill towards victims when she said there was no alternative. I can't think of anything more hurtful. One of the outstanding images that's emblazoned upon my mind as I come down the Shankill's on a mural is of a fireman with a wee baby, maybe of less than 1 year of age, wrapped in swaddling clothes, getting taken out of the Balmoral furniture showroom when the baby was killed by the IRA. And
Ron, if you come down a different road in Belfast, you'll see images relating to massacres that the British Army were involved in. Or you'll see Bombay Street, or you see something that alludes to the RUC murdering people. So you have to understand, you know well as I do, that there are victims who watch yesterday's events and are not happy because they lost people because the British Army or British forces killed them. But people in the society do want to move on. They know it's a delicate process. But I do think this is a moment now where questions should be asked of senior figures within unionism. How are you going to reciprocate if we're going to move forward? You see, if we're talking about First Minister, I think we should have a Deputy First Minister for all too. I think if we're going to move forward as a society, people need to be challenged. It's never going to be fully agreed. But what this is about is leadership moments.
A society that isn't built on law and order and injustice is a society that's built upon the sand. It won't stand. You try to equate the British Army with the IRA and all of this, and you don't see yourself that you're perpetuating my belief. You can't equate the two. The British Army are not comparable with the Republican movement and the atrocities that were played out by terrorist movements on both sides of the community, and the slaughter of Protestants and Catholics over decades in Northern Ireland. There was an alternative. You can't equate the two. And if I don't stand with the victims, then who will? Now, you've let a challenge down to unionism there to step up to the plate on all of this. Unionism was at the cenotaph yesterday. By far the biggest proportion of councillors in Belfast City Hall is the DUP, and they were there. And I don't condemn them for that. But I do think being the smaller party there, I was in a privileged position to make a stand for victims that wouldn't detract from the event. The event was carried off in a dignified manner still for those that did attend. But I do think that there had to be a voice for victims. I couldn't attend it yesterday because of that legacy issue. I meant no offence to anybody, and it was a difficult decision. But until there is a sincere movement from within Republicanism to address their violent past, then I couldn't have shared that platform yesterday.
Can I ask Chris Donnelly, Ron McDowell is wondering whether it was sincere from Michelle O'Neill. So finally, Chris, why now? Why do you think Sinn Féin and Michelle O'Neill are doing it now?
Well, I think the trajectory has been quite obvious. I mean, it was over two decades ago that Alex Maskey, as a Sinn Féin mayor, laid a laurel wreath at I think it was a Somme commemoration. And that's why I was very clear at the start that Sinn Féin have been, up until this point, have been saying to their own community, but also to the unionist community, we want to find a way that respects... It's a two-way thing at all times, Stephen. It's about saying there's difference in the society and we have to respect each other's rights to remember. But we also have to see, is there a way that we can frame things to move things on? So up until now, Sinn Féin kind of drew the line to say that we will be involved in a civic leadership way in acknowledging Irish men who fought in British wars of World War I and World War II. The difficulty for Sinn Féin now is they're pushing that further out. They're getting involved in remembrance events, which relates to, and to use the provocative phrase that Ron might allude to, victim makers, the victim makers of the RUC that are in present memory, that are alive in people's memories, the victim makers of the parachute regiment, the B Special. Now, I use that phrase and I'm paraphrasing what others would say. I don't like using that phrase, but it is really important because often this conversation is one way that it often we don't recognize that British remembrance in the society is viewed by very many people as something that is offensive. So if Sinn Féin are leading their people to say, we need to find a way to not just respect it, but actually being involved in it, taking that kind of risky leadership position, then I think for the sake of our society, there does need to be reciprocation. There does need to be leading figures within the unionist political and civic world who acknowledge the significance of this moment and say, we need to find a way to be involved in Republican commemoration. That doesn't mean we support everything that happened in the past. That's not what it's about. It's about saying, okay, if this is where we're going, if this is a further step towards solidifying peace, solidifying, you know, the pursuit of something better in the society, then it requires reciprocation. Because if it doesn't, Michelle O'Neill is going to find herself in a perilous position, and so is Sinn Féin. Okay. And you saw the initial reaction from people in Tyrone. That is widely felt out there across the nationalist and Republican base.
Chris Donnelly, Ron McDowell, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Well, obviously, lots of you calling us about this. Philip's in Belfast. Morning, Philip.
Hello, Stephen. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Stephen, just a few things. The thing that should bring this community together is that the fact that Republicans, if you want to call them nationalists, Catholics, fought together alongside the British, certainly the First and Second World War. And, you know, I remember contacting the British Legion to be able to get a copy to specific war conflicts like World War One and World War Two and things like that. But I can see how it makes Republicans angry too because of the conflict here in Northern Ireland, with the British Army being here.
I think one of the questions this morning is, should Michelle O'Neill have done more to bring her base with her for this? Did this feel that it was happening a year too early? You could criticise it for not doing it and say it's a year too late. Alex in Lisburn. Morning, Alex.
Morning. No, Steve, I just think I've fallen the coverage of these people in Tyrone who are complaining, and I recognise some of the names. The relatives of people who were killed at Loughgall, the relatives of people who were killed in Cook. And you know, the simple, brutal truth is those guys headed out thinking they had the upper hand in terms of the level of force, and they found that they were outgunned, and they paid the price for it. But I would add that what the relatives should be asking, and what the Republicans should be asking this question is this: say they had succeeded in Loughgall and wiped out the entire Loughgall station party, there'd have been 20 applicants for every vacancy. If they'd killed 6 police officers and they went, the RUC would replace them, there'd been 20 applicants for every job. What did they achieve? The Republican movement say, O'Neill says there's no alternative. I'd like to hear what she thinks was achieved by the campaign of violence that was achieved by all those deaths. But Sinn Féin's popularity in the polls only went up when they stopped.
Okay. Alex,
and that's the biggest tragedy.
Alex, thank you. We'll pause there. 030-3080-5555. Lots of you want to talk about this morning. Let's do it straight after the news. The Stephen Dolan Show. Now, we're just hearing about a banner which has been put on the office, the outside, the shutters of the office of Michelle O'Neill in Cookstown. And the banner says, "Traitors." And has red hands, red finger, red handprints posted all over it. This on the office of Cathal Mallaghan and Michelle O'Neill. And the O in the traitors is a poppy. This poster put on the shutters of Michelle O'Neill. Let's find out if the Belfast Telegraph's Alison Morris knows anything about this. Morning, Alison. What do you know? Good morning.
Well, as you said, that banner has appeared after Michelle O'Neill laying that laurel wreath at the cenotaph yesterday. And we know that over 100 families had signed a letter in opposition of that move from in and around Tyrone, where there seems to be really strong feeling against the move by Sinn Féin. She said there was a poll in today's Belfast Telegraph that say Sinn Féin are only, I think they're only 2 points down, but Michelle O'Neill's popularity herself had dropped, and albeit that poll was carried out before there was an announcement in terms of Remembrance Day. There is very strong feeling among some of those families who I've spoken to who lost loved ones. And I don't think it's in relation as much to her appearance at the Cenotaph. It's at this time when there has been so much unresolved legacy. So a lot of those families had, some of them had inquests, which ended without conclusion because disclosure was withheld from the coroner. All of those issues that remain unresolved, some asked for inquiries, such as the Fox and McCurney family, and that was denied by the British government. I think if we were in a better place in terms of legacy and where that is, that there might have been a different reaction from some of those families. It is problematic for Sinn Féin, but I mean, I suppose in their favour is the fact that there's not going to be another election here until 2027. While it was widely received, and I was writing a piece about this yesterday and spoke to people, and a lot of people said it was the right move to make, that it was...
A lot of people within Sinn Féin, their base.
No, a lot of people within Sinn Féin's base think that it was the right move, and a lot don't. And I'll tell you, the people who I've spoken to who said that they didn't agree with it, it wasn't necessarily that they agreed with what happened. It was that there was no prior discussion ahead of it. They felt that there should have been maybe meetings with their membership ahead of this to discuss it and test the water. Rather than just announce that this was happening. So there's a lot of mixed feelings. You'll see some people who will say 100% that it was the right time to do it, the right thing. Others would say it's too soon. And what Chris Donnelly was saying there, I was listening, is a lot of people are saying, why do we keep making these gestures when there's no reciprocation whatsoever? And that all you hear from unionism is a sort of demand for sackcloth and ashes from Sinn Féin, but nobody wanting to reciprocate those big moves. If you go back to when we started having these, I suppose, gestures and look at Martin McGuinness meeting the Queen and shaking the Queen's hand, well, we know now that the Queen was advised by some people not to do that, but made that decision herself to do that. That was a move of both of those people, made a decision in terms of reconciliation to have that handshake, but it was reciprocated by the Queen. It was reciprocated in terms of what Republicans took a step forward, and the monarchy took several steps forward as well to make that happen. Whereas these gestures are happening and people are saying, what's coming back? Where's the reciprocation for that?
So why did they do it this year, Alison? Why now? And if they hadn't, Sinn Féin usually very good discussing matters, preparing matters for their base. Why didn't they do it this year?
Well, this is the first time that Michelle O'Neill has been First Minister that we've had a Remembrance Day. So it's the first time she'd have had to make a decision as First Minister whether or not she was going to attend these events. As we know, the invitations for these events are sent out to the Joint Office, to the First and Deputy First Minister's Office, and there would have had to be a decision whether she was going to do it, whether someone else was going to go in her place, whether they were going to do what has been done in the past, where Sinn Féin have sent members early that morning to Lair Reith, but not attend the actual event. So those discussions seemed to have went on at a leadership level but weren't trickled down. I know that the membership were only told, the Sinn Féin members only had a discussion about this about a week ago when the decision had already been made. And some of them, I think, are upset that they weren't included, that their views weren't considered. But I think this year is simply because Michelle O'Neill took that office of First Minister and said she would be a First Minister for all.
And do you think that is punching through within the wider electorate? Does she feel like a First Minister for all?
I think that her and Little Pengelly are both doing a great job working together at a time when things are clearly very difficult. I mean, also, if you look at that poll in the Belfast Telegraph today, when people are asked if they think that the Assembly would survive till the next election, quite a large number of specifically unionists don't. They don't think that it's gonna survive, that it could well collapse again. And we know that our government's very precarious and seems to be in a cycle of eternal, of total chaos at all times. There's always another crisis coming down the line. But in terms of the executive office, they seem to be working quite well together. They stood side by side yesterday. And we can see that is being well received by people on the ground. They like to see those two, leaders of unionism and republicanism working side by side. But how it's actually trickling down into delivery and the executive's another thing, but I suppose that's a conversation for a different day. I don't think people think that the executive is delivering in the way that it should be. And we could come to a crisis that could very well collapse it, and all of these gestures might well have been for nothing.
Gavin has said he won't collapse it. Gavin Robertson, leader of DUP, he said he won't collapse it.
Do you know what we always say is events? We really don't know what's coming down the line. And the thing is, we can say in the current situation and what's happened, no, I can't see any appetite for collapsing. But then again, we don't know if, you know, there's an RHA lurking somewhere down the line or some other scandal. I don't see any will to collapse it at this point in time. But it's interesting that the electorate see that it's always precarious and it could well go at any time. And I know some other commentators feel the same way. They think it could well collapse. I don't see an appetite for it. And I don't think that at this point in time, right now, Sinn Féin's obviously attention is on the elections in the South. And once that's over, I really genuinely do think that within the party, you'll see maybe some restructuring in terms of how they handle things, because these crises that they've faced, a lot of that is to do with internal management and leadership within the internal workings of the party.
And that Lucid Talk poll that you're talking about that's in the Belfast Telegraph, Claire Hannah replacing Michelle O'Neill as the most popular Northern Ireland leader in that poll. 54% of voters rate her positively, with Emma Little-Pengelly next, 51%. Michelle O'Neill has plunged 12 points to 41%. That puts her at fifth behind Mike Nesbitt and Gavin Robinson.
Yeah, and she was the most popular leader for quite some time in those polls. So that is a big dip for her personal popularity. I thought it was interesting when I looked at the figures that the Sinn Féin vote itself didn't drop down as much as her personal popularity, which would sort of indicate that people think that this is a management problem, it's a leadership problem, rather than, and you know, something that is affecting the entire party's vote. Claire Hannah is a very capable leader, and I think it's interesting that you've seen her popularity grow. I think that the people who should probably be most concerned about the restructuring of the SDLP and the new leadership under Claire Hannah are probably Alliance, because we can see that a lot of those softer votes could very well, and do in South Belfast, go to Claire Hannah. The Sinn Féin issue, especially what's going on in Tyrone with a lot of those families, you shouldn't underestimate how important that is, because that letter that was signed by people, there's some of those people on that list who would be names that would be known to me and who would be considered not dissident in a sort of violent dissident way, but dissident in a political way, and that they parted ways from Sinn Féin quite some time ago. But also on that list is Barry McAuliffe's wife, and nobody could consider that she is politically dissident in terms of her family's relationship with Sinn Féin. So there is a problem there. As I say, it's probably lucky there's not an election until 2027. Where would those votes go? Those Republicans in Tyrone aren't going to vote for the Alliance or the SDLP, but they could just not come out and vote at all, and that would be a real problem.
And finally, here we are talking about Michelle O'Neill's woes in terms of her falling down that poll. Whether she cares about that or not, obviously we can't get inside her head. But what about the unionist parties within that Lucid Talk poll, Alison, and how the DUP are faring with their popularity?
Yeah, well, the DUP, I think, are slightly up, but Gavin Robinson's popularity is not great. Let's say it's interesting that the TUV, for the first time in that poll, overtook the Ulster Unionist Party, which is an interesting development. But I don't think that there has been the punishment of the DUP in terms of that sea border deal and what they said. We know that they've admitted that they over-egged that Geoffrey Donaldson had over-egged that in terms of what it was going to deliver. But there's no big punishment coming from that. But there's no big surge either. You know, they are quite static. And we do see that if we suppose hardline unionism, that's what a TUV branch of unionism is now changed, I suppose, to become something that many unionists see, consider a proper alternative. And I think that what's interesting is Jim Allister moving to Westminster, and the fact that Ron McDowell, who you had on, whose profile has been raised now, it no longer looks, I suppose, like a party of one man. You can see that the TV now looks like a party of several parts, which I suppose is maybe part to do with how they are now becoming the voice of that sort of hardcore unionism. I don't think that the DUP will be overly concerned about what's in that poll. And these polls, as we always say, they're a snapshot of public opinion at any one time, and things can change, events can change, and fortunes can change very quickly.
Alison Morris, thank you very much, from the Belfast Telegraph. We're expecting the First Minister, the Deputy First Minister, so Michelle O'Neill, Emma Little-Pengelly, and the Finance Minister, Keith Archibald, to be doing a press conference very soon indeed about this monitoring round. That's basically when they tell us all and tell the other departments within government of the cash that's flowing around that hasn't been spent. A monitoring round decides where to put those unspent funds. They're going to be doing a press conference. We can see in our monitors that they're getting that ready, so we'll be trying to go live to that during the programme this morning. Brendan in North Belfast. Morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Stephen. I don't know why people are surprised that Michelle O'Neill has attended a ceremony or Remembrance Day on behalf of Sinn Féin, because Sinn Féin are known as the flip-flop party now all across Ireland. You know, one week they want the word mother removed from the Irish Constitution. They want to break up the Irish Constitution. They were an anti-establishment party who are now a pro-European Union establishment party. You know, they want the Brits out and everybody else in. They've kind of turned their back on Irish nationalists, so you're mainly Catholics. You know, they've embraced abortion.
Well, the most populous nationalist party in Northern Ireland, aren't they? And they have their most popular, sorry.
There's no direction anymore, Stephen, other than trying to sell a United Ireland to people. And it's not a United Ireland, it's a new Ireland that looked like nothing that anybody wants or fought for.
Why do you say that? What way do you want them to look?
Because, well, the Irish laws are being written in Brussels. You know, by the time this is all finished, the new island comes, we'll not own the greater grass on this island. If you had enough money, you could probably buy County Mayo, and Sinn Féin will help you back.
What are you talking about?
Sinn Féin are the flip-flop party, Stephen. They've turned their back on Irish nationalists. They are pro-European unionists.
What do you
they
make of that?
They do not care about the island of Ireland. They do not care who rules Ireland. They're taking the one off the Brits.
Did you vote for Sinn Féin?
European Union. They want to rip up the Irish Constitution. They want to vote our babies. They want to promote trans ideology in our schools.
Did you vote for Sinn Féin?
Can
this man not hear me? What?
I used to until they brought an abortion like many other nationalists and Republicans. It was a bitter pill to swallow. It was one too much. But here we go again.
So where do you put your vote now if you've abandoned Sinn Féin? Who do you vote for now?
They keep giving us these bitter pills. They keep giving us better pills to swallow and one pill too many. You've turned their back on the Irish people.
What do you make of the banner up in Michelle O'Neill's office? Traitors. What do you make of that?
She's a traitor. She's a traitor. They're all traitors. If good men starve themselves to death and fought for this country.
So you don't think she should try to be a First Minister for all?
Well, the only reason they're doing it now is to save grace for their face. They've destroyed themselves. Sinn Féin have destroyed themselves. And they've known for months and months about all this paedophilia in their ranks. And that's why they're signing up to attend Remembrance Day events and Northern Ireland football games, etc., etc. On a good faith, yeah, that would have been great, but it's not a good faith. This is all to save the grace or to save the faith of Sinn Féin. Okay. It's destroyed nationalist communities, destroyed Catholic communities. Our children are being aborted. 40,000 babies aborted in the Isle of Arran in 2016.
Brendan, thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Peter in Banbridge. Morning, Peter.
Yes, Stephen. No, I'm not too sure who I'm replying to. I think it was Alex from Lisbon that said, what was achieved? If I'm right. Have I got that right? I'm not too sure.
Well, I have no idea what you're calling us about, so you tell me.
I'm calling you about Alex. If it was Alex from Lisbon, and I'm not accusing him if he didn't do it, is he said, what was achieved?
Well, you tell us what you think.
Well, I know what was achieved. Democracy, equality. And there's not too many people on your programme that live through the RUC and the V-Men. You know, we had no democracy here in Northern Ireland. In 1961, I had to leave this place. I couldn't, you probably don't know it, you weren't born. I couldn't get a job, and the law here was us, the unionists, run this place for the first 50 years at Northern Ireland. And if you couldn't get a job, you couldn't get a house. And if you couldn't get a house, you couldn't get a vote. You know, it was a one-way street. All the houses, history proves it, and it's well documented that nationalists didn't get houses because...
But that iconic imagery of Michelle O'Neill laying a wreath, what did you make of that, Peter?
I'm sure it was a big step on her behalf. You know, it wasn't easy. I'm not a Republican. I'm a non-violent nationalist. I don't believe in violence, whether British state nor the Irish state or the IRA unionist. I don't care who they are. But I'm sure it wasn't easy for her, you know.
Well, let's see if Frida agrees. Morning, Frida.
Oh, good morning, Stephen.
A brave move, says Peter. Michelle O'Neill laying that wreath.
No, I don't think it was. I think it was just to suit her own ends, Stephen. And to lay a poppy, or to lay a laurel wreath, as she did and as her counterpart did over in London. was just an insult, because the soldiers fought in the poppy fields in Flanders, and that's why there's poppy wreaths. But they weren't racing drivers, and so to put on Laura Rees was an insult. And she should just have stayed at home, because you would rather somebody who is up front and tells the truth, because then rather...
Stephen, we'll come back to you after 10 this morning. Stay there, because the First Minister has started speaking about this monitoring round when money's going to be divvied up. Let's dip into Michelle O'Neill, who's speaking live now at Stormont.
...for more investment, and in this budget alone, that has resulted in an additional £124 million for our departments here. Today's allocation underlines this executive's commitment to transforming our health service and to strengthening our education system, with each department receiving £350 and £171 million respectively. I think that equates to 57% of the budget for health alone. Also, the Finance Minister has allocated £17 million to mitigate against the shameful cut to the winter fuel payment to protect our most vulnerable pensioners. Kiva has also allocated £64 million to invest in our wastewater infrastructure, build more homes and to cut housing waiting lists. We recognise, obviously, there's still an awful lot more to do, and we're dealing with a shortfall of nearly £140 million. One budget by itself wasn't going to be enough to reverse the toxic legacy of austerity which we've been dealing with and which has damaged our public services for the last 14 years. But despite all of this, this unprecedented level of funding from this budget clearly demonstrates how underfunded that we actually have been and how much more needs to be done. But as a four-party executive, we're committed to continue to work hard to fight for better investment in our public services.
Okay. I think everybody recognises we are working within very tight financial constraints, and despite the initial injection
of cash,
because our public services were under significant pressure, there still are significant pressures that remain. And with finite resources, we need to focus on those areas where we can make most difference. The key priorities in our draft programme for government are health, education and justice, and that is why 92.6% of the general resource funding is being allocated to those three departments. We're also committed to tackling the housing crisis, and therefore we have agreed to allocate £24 million for the delivery of an additional 1,400 social houses this financial year. We're very aware that the change to the UK government's winter fuel payment scheme will have a detrimental impact on many people, and we've all opposed that and made those views very clear. And while we don't have the financial capability to mitigate against it fully, we have determined that we will do what we can to support those in need. And that is why we have allocated £17 million to the winter fuel support. And our Communities Minister, Gordon Lyons, will be working hard to ensure that that is targeted towards those most vulnerable and those at need. The financial challenges are considerable, however. We are committed and working in partnership to deliver. We will continue using our networks here and at Westminster to press the UK Government for further investment while doing all that we can to ensure the proper allocation and distribution of those public funds.
So that's the First Minister, Deputy First Minister, the Finance Minister about to speak. We're going to the news at 10 o'clock right now. Coming off the back of that, we'll speak to our Economics and Business Editor, John Campbell, and just start to understand what is being announced here and how the money is being divvied up. First, the news at 10. Let's head to our Economics Business Editor, John Campbell, now. He can let us know what's been happening. We dipped into that press conference. The Finance Minister is still speaking, First and Deputy First Minister. But this money that's bubbling around, John, called in this monitoring round, unspent funds, where are they telling us they're going to put it?
Well, most of it is going into health. That's usually what happens in these monitoring rounds. And the money which has been distributed today is largely the money which the executive got through the Westminster budget. So there's about £700 million being split up. I think about £350 million of that is going to the Department of Health. And then there are also big allocations to education and to justice.
So is that £350 million what Nesbitt asked for?
I'm not sure yet. We haven't heard from him. The press conference is still going on. The Deputy First Minister was being asked about whether all ministers supported this monitoring round. She said the majority of them did, so that might give us a clue as to potentially what his attitude might be, because my understanding is that the Department of Health wanted £320 million solely to settle pay claims, and there's maybe about another £100 million or so which they said they would need it on top of that to deal with all their pressures. And clearly with $350 million, they are still short of that amount. So I'm assuming that through the day we will hear something from the Department of Health about where exactly this allocation leaves them. But the finance minister was saying, well, listen, no minister got everything that they wanted in this budgeting exercise. They were never going to get everything they wanted.
We were listening to Boucher, John Boucher, the chief constable at the policing board, on Thursday. He repeatedly warned about the implications of the £37 million shortfall in the PSNI's budget this year. Let's just remind people, we've clipped up some of what he said last Thursday. Have a listen.
I'm determined to continue to highlight the deficiency in funding for this organisation and will do so. I will continue to do so until we receive the financial support that's required to keep communities safe in Northern Ireland. The budget announcement of an extra £1.5 billion, taking the total grant now for Northern Ireland to £18.2 billion, is incredibly welcome. It is imperative that the budget of the PSNI finally achieves the support of other public services, such as health and education, that they've received in recent years. Our headcount is dangerously low. I know you understand that, but it's important everybody understands that. Dangerous both to the health of the workforce, but importantly for the safety of society in Northern Ireland.
Well, we're sorry for the quality of that clip, but we heard the Chief Constable loud and clear there. Their head count, John, dangerously low. That was Boucher fighting for money. Do we know if he's got what he wants out of this?
Well, there's, I think, about 40 million odd will be going to the Department of Justice. Now, the issue there is that the Department of Justice isn't just a policing department. There's also responsible for the prison service, which is also under pressure, and the courts. And we know that there's currently industrial action being taken by criminal law barristers over the fees they get. So there is going to be some additional money going to the Department of Justice. But I think it might be a little later in the day before we know exactly how that then is split up within that department.
So that's a key decision then for the Justice Minister, Naomi Long. If she's getting 40 million, Boucher's looking 37 million of it, or that's his shortfall, then how does she turn to the prison service? What does she say to the other demands on her department? What way does she cut up her 40 million, right?
Yeah, I think generally the way the monitoring round works is rather than just bidding for a sum of money, you say, here is a specific thing which I need to do, and here's the amount of money that I will need to do it. So it depends on specifically what bids she has made. It is like a process of negotiation with the Department of Finance basically coordinating this. So as the day develops, we will get more information about how exactly each department intends to use their money. So, for example, we were told in the press conference there that the executive is going to make $17 million available to the Department for Communities to partially mitigate the cut in the winter fuel payment. Now, it won't come anywhere near mitigating that entirely. And again, it will be down to the minister there, Gordon Lyons, as to how precisely he uses that money. There's also going to be £24 million for construction of social houses, and we know that there was a lot of criticism that the social housing budget had been badly cut. So there's a couple of specific projects were mentioned in the press conference but it will be later in the day before we get full details.
So that's £17 million of extra money for some pensioners. We don't know what pensioners will get it. We don't know what the criteria will be. We'll find out maybe later in the day, John. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I assume it'll basically fund whatever some existing schemes are, because it would be quite a small amount of money to try and set up a new scheme. Right. So I don't know exactly what it will be, but clearly it's not going to be a like-for-like replacement.
And the £24 million in social housing, will that be for projects, finally, John, where the planning permission has been given already? Because we keep on hearing about the difficulties of planning applications, given the lack of water infrastructure capability in this country.
I don't know. It's a bit early to say with that level of detail.
Okay. John Campbell, thank you very much. I'm sure we'll hear from you throughout the day. Frida and Mahara, we promise we'll come back to you. This is about Michelle O'Neill laying a wreath. You're describing it as an insult, Frida.
Yes, I did indeed, Stephen.
But you described this as an insult, and yet Sinn Féin and your First Minister is saying that this is an example of reaching out, of trying to show that she is here for everybody.
Oh, Stephen, if you believe that lie, you believe anything. It's just like this. There will only be peace in this country from people who were involved in the warfare and terrorism that went on in this country. It's only when they get down on their knees and repent before the Lord Jesus Christ of their sins and turn over their lives that then there is sincere and absolute a testimony of having left Eva behind and a turning to the Lord to bring peace. But for Michelle O'Neill to lay a laurel wreath and her counterpart in London to do the same, the British Legion should have refused those wreaths to be laid because, after all, it was supposed to be poppy wreaths. The soldiers, when they fought in the wars, they fought in Flanders fields among the poppies. And that was an absolute insult, and it'd been better not doing that at all. Of course, everyone in this country wants peace, and we don't want the younger people growing up as we did from the 60s. No one wants to relive those days again.
Okay.
And even on both sides, Stephen, there was a programme on some time on television called Once Upon a Time in Northern Ireland, and we saw people who really were involved and who regretted it.
Frieda,
and they did repent.
And
that's what we need in this country.
Repentance.
We need genuine truthfulness.
I hear you. Frieda, thank you very much. Thank you. Morning to you. We're going to move on, if you don't mind. The Northern Trust is warning patients they may wait longer to be seen because of demand on its emergency department. And this is also an interesting part of this story, the new introduction of a patient's record system is causing delays. The Encompass system went live last Thursday. The Trust has told The Nolan Show there was disruption as staff adapted to this new system. Antrim Area Hospital dealing with a high number of patients at its A&E. The Trust has apologised. Erica Horner got in touch with our programme. Morning to you, Erica.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. This was in relation to your 78-year-old mum.
That's correct, yeah.
Tell me what happened.
Okay, so I phoned the GP to get the results of some tests, and he had suggested that we get her up to A&E as soon as possible.
Your mum has cancer.
She's cancer, yes. She was diagnosed with cancer in February, and she has her spine is fractured in two places due to the cancer. So basically, we were taking her up to A&E because she was extremely breathless and her kidney function had reduced, so they were very concerned about that. So we headed up to A&E. We were told that there was going to be an urgent care referral made. So basically, we expected to get to A&E and be ushered through pretty quickly to see someone. We arrived at A&E at 3 o'clock. Mum did get triaged on very, very quickly. The place was absolutely packed, Stephen, and there was no room to sit. The smell, the heat of it was absolutely awful. So we negotiated my mum into a corner in her wheelchair and waited and waited and waited. Now, obviously having cancer, we were concerned about, her infection, etc. So I'd asked several times when we were going to be seen. The receptionist basically said, go into the back, see if anyone there can help you. So at 7 o'clock, after 4 hours, I went into the back of A&E and asked to speak to someone, explain mum's circumstances, and they told us to come through with her in the wheelchair and they would do something. So we basically sat in the corridor until...
So while your mum's sitting
ready,
in the corridor, fractures on her spine because of her cancer, that must be incredibly painful.
Unbelievably so. I mean, she can't lie down flat, Stephen. Whenever she's at home, she's sitting with cushions and pillows around her to ease the pain. She's been sitting in her wheelchair, her own personal wheelchair, for 4 hours in absolute agony. But whenever the
Which is distressing, not just for her, obviously, and she's the priority here, but you witnessing that and you're wanting to alleviate your mother's pain.
Exactly. I'm looking at my mum, 4'10" of her, absolutely broken, distressed, in pain. She's also partially sighted and has hearing difficulties too. So the confusion and the distress that woman was feeling was horrendous. And I and my sister felt totally responsible in trying to do something to help her. You know, we were at the end of our tether, Stephen, being perfectly honest. And thankfully, we did get her into a room.
You'd been triaged by, sorry to cut across you, you'd been triaged by 3:30 in the afternoon. At 11 o'clock that night, still no doctor consultation, right?
Still no doctor. I had been out several times to ask the senior nurse, because we were right beside the nurse's station, could I have pillows for her? She was in absolute agony. The bed they put her in was damp. The sheets were damp because it had just been washed down. There was no pillows. I asked three times, could we get pillows, and was told there are no pillows. So we used our coats and our bags to try and prop my mum up to give her a bit of comfort. She was crying. We gave her her own medication that thankfully we had brought with us. By about 5 to 12, I lost it, Stephen, I really did. And I went out for the fourth time to the senior nurse and said, my mum is lying in here and she is crying. She is screeching. Can we not get pillows to alleviate her pain? And I was told, dear, we don't have any pillows. I said, but she's crying in there. Can you not? She's in pain. She's screeching out. And the senior nurse said, I can't hear her. Well, at that, I mean, they had been concentrating on the screens the whole time. It was as if there weren't patients about. It was constantly looking at the screens, working out this system. So I ended up, I said to the nurse, are you calling me a liar? My mum is screeching. And she said, I don't hear her. And I said, right, that's fine.
Well, that nurse will have been dealing with many different patients across the ward. And the resources that that nurse does not have is not her fault. Is it?
Exactly. I get that, Stephen. It's not her fault, but it's the lack of compassion. Those nurses are totally burnt out. Now, in fairness, she did, whenever I mentioned your name, she did follow me back into the room. And within, she looked at my mum.
Whenever
said,
you mentioned your mother's name?
No, whenever I mentioned your name, because I said, I'm speaking to Nolan about this. This is absolutely disgraceful. She followed me into the room. She asked my mum how she was. My mum let out a howl that... it was horrendous. It was like a wounded animal. She ran out, and within 5 minutes, a consultant was with us. So it took all of that for us to get a consultant to see my mum.
Now, the new system that there is, this new, I couldn't remember what you call it, it's called the Encompass system, isn't it?
That's right, yeah.
Did that contribute to the delay?
I would say yes, it did. There was certainly people on the floor trying to help the nurses use the system and navigate the system. And they were very focused on trying to use it. It wasn't giving them the information that they needed. And Stephen, I totally get that. I work with IT as well. It can be difficult. But what really upset me was my mum wasn't looked at once. They were focused so much on this system and trying to negotiate their way around it that No one came into the room to see my mum. I had to go and search for them. And being honest, to stay at the end without any pillows, I walked around that A&E until I found a trolley with a pillow lying on it.
But they're stretched, aren't they?
And brought it back to my mum.
You're being critical of some of the staff here, but they are stretched beyond belief. The system can't cope.
I get that, Stephen. It is absolutely ridiculous. And you know what? I notice in the A&E, they are definitely burnt out. The volume of people they are dealing with is atrocious. The system did not contribute to it. But my concern is it's the lack of compassion. Now, my mum eventually got up onto a ward. And once she was in the ward, she has been looked after extremely well up there by the nurses. And you know what? It's not the nurses' fault.
How is she now?
I get that there. She had a good night's sleep last night. She's thankfully getting her medication on time. I mean, at one stage, she was 5 hours overdue with her morphine. And I was running around after a nurse trying to get her morphine into her.
Well, Alan Stouch, listening
situation.
To this, chair of the GP committee of the BMA. Good morning to you, Alan.
Good morning, Stephen.
Doesn't sound good, this. I emphasise again that these nurses who are being criticised, they're stretched, they don't have the resources, they're working harder than most of us listening to this programme this morning. But this new Encompass system, is it going to take a while to bed in, and are there going to be problems until it does?
I think it's adding, certainly, to a lot of the pressures. I mean, you know, it becomes almost impossible to add to some of these stories because we hear them over and over and over again. The impact on patients is very, very clear. The impact on staff is massive as well. And whenever I hear that lack of compassion sort of phrase, I mean, that just fills me with terror because we have staff that are are burnt out. They're really struggling. It's year-long pressures. And they're put under this tremendous psychological pressure as well. And that is simply, I mean, even when we talk about the pay award, which we're in the middle of November, and it still hasn't been confirmed. I know we're about to hit this monitoring round and so on. But we've got to look after our staff as well, because if we don't have staff and if we don't have well staff, then the ability to look after the patients diminishes as well.
What is this new system going to do, this Encompass system? Went live last Thursday. The Trust has told us that there was disruption as staff adapted to this new system. The Northern Trust have told us this. What's it do, Alan?
Yeah, so I think the Northern Trust is the third of the trusts to release it. It started in South Eastern Trust. It's now implemented in Belfast, and it's now gone to Northern Trust. And, I mean, we've got to be realistic. IT is such an important part of the health service going forward. But to implement a huge new system like this is bound to have an impact. And we know that that's had an impact on our waiting times, which were already bad as well. But hopefully... And I'm no IT expert, but hopefully with time it'll start to improve the system, because you'll get a much more joined up system where you don't have multiple different IT systems that don't necessarily communicate with each other.
So this allows all the doctors to all the hospitals to talk to each other about a patient. Does the information flow from your GP into the system too?
There is bits of the GP record go in. The actual mainstay of a patient record is still the GP record, and we've had fully IT, fully electronic records for many, many years. But this is very much about when you go to the hospital and the trusts, and different members of staff will be able to access a complete patient record, as opposed to have to go into lots and lots of different systems to get different.
It's crazy that isn't sorted already, is it not?
It is, yeah. And again, you know, from a general practice perspective, it is unusual, because we've been fully electronic for many, many years. And when a patient comes in to see us, you know, we would be able to access every piece of information about them. But it's about the large trusts and that's huge.
And here we are. Sorry, Alan. Here we are obviously talking about systems, and we all know that there are people at the heart of every one of these systems. Ian in Sainfield. Morning to you, Ian.
Good morning, Stephen. Good morning.
Good morning. And look, thank you for talking to us. And look, I get it myself. My mum was in hospital recently, and it's a hard time. Your mother's 95 and in hospital. Mum was at hospital. Is she okay?
She's fine now. She's out and has been through the system. But you're talking about the Encompass. That was one of the reasons why. And we were out of the hospital at 6. And it was half three before she actually saw a doctor. Now,
and in the morning, 6 p.m. to 3 a.m.
6 p.m. to 3 a.m. Yes, 6 p.m. to 3 a.m. And
was she in pain?
Yes, she had broken ribs.
A 95-year-old sat for 9 hours with broken ribs without getting pain relief.
Yes, in a wheelchair.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Now, you know, the place was slammed, but the doctor actually apologised to us. And to be honest, now, it's that long ago, you won't be able to find the doctor, and there'll be no consequences, but he apologised and said half the people shouldn't be there. But it was the Encompass system. The staff weren't trained enough or trained at all on how the system worked. So therefore, everything was just slower to get things done, to find out things. And you thought it was going to be rolled out. I think our area was the first up here around the Ulster. But it was supposed to be rolled out around the rest of the country. You would have thought they would have learnt their lesson, that staff needed more training, or if there were glitches, they should have been dealt with.
So again, the reality for you, you're sitting in hospital, you're watching your mum in pain, and you can't do anything about it. That's incredibly distressing.
Yes. That's putting it mildly, yes. But I'm not the only one. You know, this is replicated all over the country. And it's the whole system is broken. There's people there because they either can't get a doctor's appointment, or they're working full-time and don't feel as if they can take time off work, so they go up in the evening. and then they just sit.
Yeah, I mean, Stephen, just to come in on that, the figures don't, I know that there's a lot of anecdote, and I know the pressure that's there, the figures don't actually support that we haven't seen a massive jump in terms of the numbers attending ED departments, but the big problem is the complexity, and it is the flow through the hospital. And actually, Ian's example, a 95-year-old attending an ED, the implications for an elderly patient arriving late at night and not being able to see. Actually, if an elderly patient arrives after 6 p.m. and ends up needing admitted, their average length of stay goes up by 2 full days, and the long-term need for social care goes up quite considerably as well. So by not having an efficient flow through the system, we end up getting problems, more and more and more problems down the line as well, in terms of how we're then trying to deal with that flow and that exit block and everything else that is described so often.
How's your mum now, Ian?
Mum's fine. She's now into a nursing home from living at home. I agree. It's throughput. It's getting people through the system. There aren't the beds on the wards, whether that's a staffing issue because of money. But it's getting people cleared off beds, and that is the Cinderella of the health service. It's those beds that when someone doesn't need critical care, but they're not well enough to go home and they need to rest and recuperate to get their strength back up. Well, those beds aren't there.
Let me say thank you to you, sir. Thank you, and Dr. Alan Stout, thank you as well. Appreciate you coming on. Peter McCarrick-Fergus will be our last call of the day. Morning, Peter.
Well, Stephen, I would have to say that the last thing I had with hospital was a mater. I took bad Dorwick with pneumonia, and I went into the ward, or into the triage, and they had me sorted out within an hour. The place is bunged with people. I actually not too sure, is that an emergency police station, or is it a hospital? You have people that's in from the cold, sitting, taking wee cups of water with their wee tablets, and then you go up in the ward, you sit for a couple of days, and I'll be honest, I couldn't wait to get out. But there's people that you hear doctors saying them, you're well to go home, they go, oh, my house is getting decorated, I can't go home to Tuesday.
Oh, come on. You heard that.
I have heard that. Stephen, I've also heard my daughter's away in hospital and I can't go home. I have heard that, and I cannot believe the attitude. So a lot of attitude is to do with some of the patients as well.
Well,
it's not a hotel, it's a hospital.
Peter, thank you. Look, the Northern Trust sent us a statement. We were talking about their NDAE this morning. They said there are high numbers of attendances. Unfortunately, due to increasing demand, some patients will remain in our ID for longer than we would like until a bed becomes available. We appreciate this can be distressing and we are sorry. They say that the Northern Trust was the third to go live with Encompass. It's a new digital patient record system. And look, they say inevitably they do expect disruption while staff adapt to that new system, and they've advised members of the public waiting times may be slightly longer than usual. Just before we go this morning, our First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, during this monitoring round press conference, has been talking about the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt.
I think that every minister on the executive table has recognised that it's going to be challenging. We don't have enough money to do all the things that we would want to do, that we've prioritised even collectively. Unfortunately, the Minister for Health didn't support the allocation today, but that is to ignore the fact that he did in fact receive 57% of the entire funding that was available to us. And Kiva has in her executive paper encouraged ministers to prioritise the issue of public sector pay, and I hope that the Health Minister can get on and do that now.
So we thought we'd bring that to you. That's the First Minister, Michelle O'Neill, indicating that the Health Minister, Mike Nesbitt, has not voted for the budget, and the implications here of ministers scrambling for as much money as they can get. And I'm sure that will all unfold throughout the day here in Radio Ulster before we come back to you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock for the biggest show in the country. Thank you for your company today. Lots of different news stories. If you've got a news story, nolan@bbc.co.uk is how you send it in to us here at the BBC. Thanks for listening today. We'll see you all tomorrow. Connor's coming up right now.
biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.